Russia hits back at the U.S. president, saying it's not for Biden to decide whether President Putin can remain in office. The Ukrainian president repeats his call for more Western military aid and asks Europeans whether they're afraid of Russia. And also in the headlines, Yemen suspending missile and drone strikes against Saudi Arabia for 3 days to give peace a chance. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, beginning with Ukraine, the U.S. president raised his eyebrows after suggesting that his Russian counterpart should not remain in office.
We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principle, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God bless you all.
Now, in response, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that a Russian president is elected by the people of Russia. It's not up to Biden to decide who should be in power in the country. The White House later explained that Biden wasn't calling for regime change in Russia. It said that a U.S. president meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. But it's okay for the U.S. to do the same thing. Now, political commentator Lawrence Davidson says Biden's comments about the Russian leader are looking a lot like those his predecessor Donald Trump would make.
It's embarrassing, actually, to have this man who really is a rather simple-minded fellow running around and destroying the basis for reconciliation and continuing ordinary diplomatic relations with Russia, because he, you know, by saying these things and alienating the Russian government, I mean, it'll make it harder in the end to bring back a normal relations. And actually, Biden sounds a lot like Trump. I mean, after all, Donald Trump had gone around the country saying Mr. Biden shouldn't be in office.
Now, President Zelensky of Ukraine is urging Western countries to provide his country with weapons and military hardware so it could defend itself against Russian attacks.
What is the price of this security? This is very, very specific. It is planes for Ukraine. It is tanks for our state. It is missile defense. It is anti-ship weapons. That is what our partners have. That is what is just gathering dust there. After all, this is all not only for the freedom of Ukraine, but for the freedom of Europe.
Now, speaking in a video address on Saturday, Zelensky said Ukraine is asking for just a tiny fraction of NATO's arms, not more. He also asked Europeans if they are afraid of Moscow and warned again that Russia's military operation could endanger the whole Europe. Zelensky insists that Russia will seek to expand further into Europe if Ukraine falls. NATO does not back his request for a no-fly zone on the grounds that it could provoke a wider war. Early in the day, Zelensky talked to his Polish counterpart and demanded a rapid transfer of Russia-made fighter aircraft from Eastern Europe to Ukraine to be used against Russian troops. In the meantime, Britain is striking a conciliatory tone toward Russia. London says that the sanctions can be lifted if Moscow commits to a full ceasefire and withdraws its forces from Ukraine. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss says for the sanctions to be removed, Russia must also give assurances that it will not attack Ukraine again. The comments echo recent remarks by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that the wide-ranging penalties against Russia can go away if Moscow changes its behavior. Blinken said the sanctions are not designed to be permanent. The West has imposed an array of sanctions on Moscow, but 1 month into the war, the Kremlin says it will continue the offensive until it accomplishes its goals of demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. Now, moving on with the rest of world news, Yemen announcing a unilateral ceasefire, suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announce the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Namashat says that Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange, and he called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says that Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to the Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and pulling out troops. The developments follow the Yemeni army's targeting multiple locations deep inside Saudi soil, including an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and vital sites in the capital, Riyadh. Meanwhile, thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of the capital, Sana'a, and several other cities to mark the National Day of Resilience. Abdul Latif al-Washadi was among the protesters and filed us this next report.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, in a rare public message of support, Israel extends sympathies to Saudi Arabia following a flurry of Yemeni strikes on multiple targets across the kingdom. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett expressed Israel's sorrow to Riyadh over the attack, which he described as horrific. He was referring to a wave of missile and drone strikes that the Yemeni army conducted on several sites deep inside Saudi Arabia on the 7th anniversary of the war 2 days ago. The strikes caused a huge fire at an Aramco oil storage facility in Jeddah. The Tel Aviv regime has no formal ties with Saudi Arabia, but the UAE and Bahrain, both allies of Riyadh, normalized ties with Israel 2 years ago. In January, Tel Aviv offered security and intelligence support to the UAE after a deadly Yemeni strike hit its capital, Abu Dhabi. Moving on, France's presidential election has been unlike any other recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating the headlines. It's the first major vote in the West since the end of the coronavirus, and that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. From Paris, Rami Mazahedi reports.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the Yellow Vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun. An unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, Israeli crop duster planes have sprayed toxic herbicides on Gaza's farmlands as Tel Aviv continues its inhumane acts of aggression against the impoverished region. Farmers in the Gaza Strip see no end in sight to their suffering as Tel Aviv continues to destroy their crops. Our correspondent has the story.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to push the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations.
Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The works of renowned Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali have been published in Italy for the first time. The publisher says the publication of late cartoonist works helps raise awareness about the Palestinian plight at the hands of the Tel Aviv regime. From Rome, Max Civelli has more.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy. Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali rappresentato.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Andala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of
radio. Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful,
Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, March 27th, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English radio programs. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program. And here I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Massimo Valentino from Italy, Bashir A. Ahmed from India, and Marcelo Miquelin from Brazil. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. So, all of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us, an electronic QSL card from us as a confirmation. And of course, my warm gratitude to those of our great listeners who have sent us letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read their emails or letters. So here we have an email from Bill McDavid from Canada, one of our regular listeners. Igor Belevich from Belarus, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Anjum Hussein from Indian Control Kashmir, of course, has sent us an email. Hector Fria Jofre from Chile has sent us an email. And the last but not the least is an email from Muhammad Aslam from India. Please stay with us. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received a lot of emails from around the world from our great listeners, and this time from Bill McDavid, one of our old and regular listeners from Canada. So let's see what Bill says. Dear IRIB English radio staff, I'm very sorry, but we were unable to receive your IRIB English radio broadcast at 2000 UTC here in North America on any frequencies. Are you still broadcasting? Please advise. Thank you, and please send an updated English language broadcast schedule that includes frequencies. Best wishes to you and your family, and happy new Iranian year. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Bill McDavid from Canada, from Iran, and from IRIB English Radio. For your information, yes, we don't have any shortwave broadcast in North America. And instead, you can refer to our website and enjoy the online broadcast of IRIB English Radio at www.parstoday.com/en. Anyway, sorry for that. Bill McDavid from Canada, thank you very much for sending us this email. Of course, in the website, you can, of course, find the frequency schedule. Sending any material, any item on behalf of IRIB English Radio is halted in the time of pandemic. So for the time being, you can refer to our website and find our frequency schedule. And my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Best wishes to you and your family, Bill McDavid from Canada. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And from Belarus, one of our regular listeners, Igor Belevich, has sent us an email. Igor says, unfortunately, there are a lot of cases of coronavirus in my country, Belarus. It is a very dangerous situation, but I'm happy to say that I have never caught coronavirus myself, mainly because I try to stay at home as much as possible. I pray health and happiness for all the people in the world, and I hope we get rid of the virus very soon. Please send me a SW radio schedule. I love Iran. Salam and warm greetings to you, Igor Belevich from Belarus. Thank you very much for sending us this email. And thank you for being committed to your radio, IRIB English Radio, because usually we receive many emails from you, Igor Belevich from Belarus. Stay committed. Anyway, what a pity that there are a lot of cases of coronavirus in your country, Belarus. I hope that this virus comes to an end very soon in your country and around the world. And then there will be more interactions around the world, including between IRIB English Radio and our great listeners. I think at the time of pandemic, the only thing we can do, as you said, is social distancing and mask wearing, the best ways we can do. Anyway, we also pray health and happiness for all people in the world, and we hope that all people around the world get rid of this virus very soon. Thank you for letting us know that you love Iran. Igor Belevich from Belarus, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And after a short break, I will be back with other emails. And here we have an email from Anjum Hussein from Indian-controlled Kashmir. So let's see what Anjum Hussein says. Salam! Norwiz greetings to all the staff of IRIB English Radio and to all those who are celebrating this occasion. I would have loved to record a message for this festive occasion, as in my part of the world, Kashmir, it's celebrated with much joy, festivity and enthusiasm. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Anjum Hussein, from the Indian-controlled Kashmir. And thank you very much for sending us this congratulatory message on Nowruz. Yes, Nowruz is the beginning of a spring, and Iranian New Year, the beginning of Iranian New Year, which Iranians are now are basking in these days. Yet it's a Nowruz holiday in Iran, and people are enjoying their actually holidays during Nowruz and the beginning of the new year. So it's great. In your region, Kashmir, people are celebrating Nowruz, and it's great. I hope that you enjoy these celebrations, and happy new year, happy new spring. Anyway, Anjum Hussein from Indian-controlled Kashmir, thank you very much for sending us this email. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. And from Chile, we've received an email from Hector Fria Jofre, one of our regular listeners, one of our old listeners. So let's see what Hector says. Dear friends of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, I send my greetings and also a report in audio enclosed to my email confirming that I have been a listener of your radio. I would like to receive information about your country, and I certainly want to obtain a QSL card or an EQSL card if it would be possible. Yours truly. Salam and warm greetings to you, Hector Friehofer from Chile. And please accept our appreciations to you for sending us this email. Of course, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. And as you may know, sending any QSL card, paper QSL card, is not possible in the time of pandemic. So, yes. We've received your audio enclosed to your email. Thank you for that. Anyway, Hector Friehofer from Chile, write to us soon and tell us your views about the programs of IRIB English Radio. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Muhammad Aslam from India. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. And Muhammad Aslam from India has sent us an email. He says, IRIB English section. Thank you for giving a quick reply to your radio listeners and website users. I appreciate your staff and the programs you air in shortwave. I can easily hear your radio since the reception is fine at my house. I have no problem in hearing the programs. Thank you. Salam, and please accept our warmest greetings to you, Muhammad Aslam from India. Thank you very much for sending us this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. Yes, we give quick reply to all our radio listeners, and we respect them all. Thank you very much for your appreciations of the staff and the programs we air in shortwave, Muhammad Aslam from India. It was a good news. So you have no problem in hearing the program? Also another good news. Thank you for reflecting your views in this email. So, Muhammad Aslam from India, write to us very soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon. And, of course, your great views about IRIB English radio programs. And time tells me we have to skip to the next section of our program, which is, of course, this week's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. We hope you'll enjoy it. And here we come to the end of this week's edition of Listeners Special. Please keep in touch with your program, and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RRE English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Fires at Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah are burning after a brutal attack by the Yemeni army. Saudi Arabia has failed to put out the fire as of yet. This is while Yemen is marking 7 years of the bombing campaign and war by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and the Saudi-backed coalition. Will Saudi Arabia come to its senses and realize it is losing this war? Or does it need the green light from the U.S., which seems content to continue selling it arms? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. Writer, journalist, and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joins us from London. Also joining us, political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell, who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. We need to talk about this and ask you your thoughts on this Yemeni operation that took place called Breaking the Siege 3, as they have called it. And it was executed against a number of vital and sensitive targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. They used domestically developed ballistic and winged missiles, as well as combat drones. And then you had the strike today that involved that, and then you had the strike just days ago. Again, a number of installations to have been targeted. So what is your reaction to that? And please take into account, if you can for us, or to put into context, the advances made by the Yemeni army versus the Saudi-backed coalition, who's has all these funds and all the resources that it needs to carry out the bombing campaign.
Well, yes. First of all, 7 years is intolerable, and we're adding humanitarian disaster upon humanitarian disaster around the world, and they're all manufactured. None of this is necessary. All this suffering. I think that the as I see what's happening in the last few days, and I speak as a pacifist. And I don't think there's a military solution to anything. But I also see that for all the technology that's given and sold, and all the intelligence that the Saudis have at their disposal, and how they're carrying on this war with fantastic civilian casualties, and attacking civilian infrastructure, and what's happening in these last few days with far fewer resources, much more carefully orchestrated attacks on the oil infrastructure and other targets, with very little collateral damage really something remarkable. But I think one of the first questions you asked in this introduction is, will the Saudis be able to end this without a green light from the United States because of all the money that this is making for U.S. corporations? Just over a year ago, February, I believe the 7th of last year, President Biden made his first public address on after his election on foreign affairs, and he announced the great fanfare: we are ending all U.S. American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, and he called it a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. He joined the world in condemning the horrible blockade and war of attrition against the Yemeni people, and immediately that was stepped back from, much more quietly, and much more quietly, millions of dollars worth of of sales have been approved, of missiles made by Raytheon and other U.S. corporations to the Saudis. I don't think this is intended by the United States anyway. I hope that the Saudis have more sense for this to ever end at all. This is a status quo to be maintained because it's very profitable.
Well, Hafsa Khair Mostafa, looking at the media in the U.S., many portray this picture that there's confusion on the part of the Biden administration. I'm wondering what confusion there is, as our guest there said, where you have a president who comes out and said, I'm going to end the war. But in reality, what we're seeing in terms of action is more arms are being sold, the latest one being $750 million.
Well, I think we have to remember that this, for the U.S., is a perfect war. It's a war that generates a lot of money, but then doesn't generate a single U.S. Victim, a U.S. soldier being sacrificed on the battleground. So this is, in essence, a perfect conflict for a country that is war-hungry and whose economy is highly reliant on the industrial war complex. So I think there is absolutely no incentive for the U.S. government to put an end to it. On the contrary, it has all the incentive to pursue it, in particular as Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, will have even more money now that oil prices have gone up, and therefore will have the financial means to continue to buy arms and therefore continue to nourish this sector of the U.S. economy. So on the U.S. side, there is absolutely no incentive. And if anything else, they're going to encourage this conflict to continue. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the Saudis really need to cut their losses. They started out in this conflict claiming that it would be a two-week thing, that it would be done within the end of the month, and obviously 7 years on, here we are, and the Houthis are being more and more efficient, digging deeper in Saudi and actually targeting very, very sensitive areas. So I think what the best outcome would be for Saudi Arabia to realize that it hasn't made a single achievement, that it's not gaining any ground against the Houthis, and that in essence today it is very similar to what the U.S. was against the Afghans or against Vietnam, far more well-equipped, yet faced with a very, very determined opponent.
Brian Terrell, let me review this with you, because it's really something that needs to be reviewed. The strike that happened today, Yemen's army fired missiles and drones. Let's see here. The Saudi energy and water desalination facilities. It pounded high-value sites in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Energy facilities in the strategic Jizan and Nadran regions, Aramco's fuel distribution station in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah. Days ago, drone strikes hit a petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region, a natural gas plant, and the Well, you see where I'm going with this. So when you're sitting in the control room, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or in the U.S., what are they thinking? I mean, I'm wondering, when they spent all this money, all this technology, all the intelligence, and we hear a lot of it comes from the U.S., but they're suffering such losses. I mean, their jewel is Aramco. I'm guessing they should really put that into context and try to get some kind of political solution going immediately.
Yes, I think it is that urgent. It's that urgent to us and to all the people of the world. It's that urgent to the people of Saudi Arabia. It's that urgent to as we're facing climate change, and we need to find alternatives and develop more efficient uses of the fuel that we have and find other fuels. We're spending all of our treasure on this. It's not a disaster if you are a major shareholder in Raytheon or in Boeing or some of these other corporations. It's seen as good news, as the CEO of Raytheon said back in February in response to the president's speech. He said, "Peace is not going to break out anytime soon." He assured the stockholders. And he predicted that the Middle East would remain an area of solid, positive growth. This is how twisted it is that the people who have to gain from this see this. They don't see this in terms of human suffering, and they don't even see this in terms of bringing the world to the brink of a world war. They don't see this in terms of millions of people starving to death. They're seeing the bottom line, and it looks good. And there isn't any incentive to change course. And the whole world needs a radical shift in course. But we're not going to see it from the people who are running the military-industrial complex and the politicians here in the United States that they own.
Well, Hafsakar Mustafa, since we're talking about this war, to have entered the eighth year, 7 years, is what we're also looking at in terms of its anniversary, which is a really depressing milestone. At some point, about 3 or 4 years into the war, there were reports that were coming out that the Saudi-led coalition at that point, there were a number of countries, it wasn't just the UAE and Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., that they were actually targeting infrastructure, whether it was agricultural infrastructure or infrastructure, for example, water or the likes, which all point to the fact that they were trying to either starve the population or lead to the death of the civilians. Do you think that was one of the intentions behind the bombing campaign that happens, that they were actually going after the civilian population?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. And we also know that Saudi Arabia has committed actual war crimes under the very standard definition of war crimes. The idea, presumably politically, would be to carry out such punitive operations against civilians that the civilians would turn against their army and actually force it to stop. But that hasn't happened. If anything, it's sort of pushed many Yemenis who were perhaps on a middle ground actually more towards the Houthi operations, because they realized that they're being punished and they're being murdered and slaughtered at the hands of a very oppressive Saudi regime that has absolutely complete disregard for Yemeni, for fellow Arab and fellow Muslim life. And this is very interesting, because obviously this is a country that has very, very similar, very close ties historically, ethnically, religiously with Yemen, and yet it isn't hesitating in carrying out these very atrocious operations against essentially what is a brotherly nation. So I think that noticing and realizing that has actually pushed many civilians in Yemen to side with the Houthis when prior to that they may not have been. So this, again, these operations have had the reverse effect of what Saudi Arabia was trying to achieve all those years ago. And so the harder they go on Yemen, the more losses they actually record on the strategic grounds.
Okay. Another point that is very interesting is that Yemen has come out in the past on a number of occasions, actually at this point, very recently, the Yemeni information minister coming out saying, you know, we're going to stop these missile strikes and our drone strikes on various targets in Saudi Arabia if the siege is lifted. Now, Saudi Arabia, for some reason, is not lifting that siege, Brian Terrell. It may be concerned about arms being transferred, perhaps. But that's a simple solution. I don't think that they're that incompetent to search UN-approved shipments that are supposed to be coming through into the territory and spread humanitarian, that is, goods to the Yemeni people. So why is it that that is not being done? Why is Saudi Arabia keen on keeping the siege?
Well, I think these most of these problems that seem intractable have simple solutions. Like I said, that lifting that siege is a simple solution, and it could only lead to positive developments. I think we have to remember that this few days ago, March 12th, that there was the Saudis carried out an execution, a mass execution of 81 men, women, and children. Even were beheaded by the Saudi kingdom. Some of them were specifically executed because they opposed the war in Yemen. And then 2 days later, the coalition invites the Yemeni leadership to come to Riyadh and for peace talks. And of course they're not going to come to Riyadh for peace talks. It was an absurd, obscene invitation, and showing that there isn't any on the side of the Saudi coalition any interest in peace, because of course they'd be risking their own lives by traveling to Saudi Arabia at the time. So there just isn't any this war would stop if there was a will to stop it. If there were the will on the part of the Saudis, a will on the part of the United States, there's certainly among the leadership in Yemen and the people of Yemen, they have every interest in stopping this war. And if that interest was met on the other side, it would simply end. These are not intractable problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting development came, Hafsakar Mustafa, just hours ago, where prior to that you had the attack that happened by the Yemeni army on the Saudi oil facilities. But just a couple hours back, you had a major announcement. The way I'm looking at it, I'm not too sure if you agree or not, if you can tell us what it means. First, that the Ansarullah movement made an announcement that it will be suspending strikes in Saudi Arabia for a period of 3 days. So that's one of the statements they made. The other was that they were ready to release all war prisoners. What do you make of those two announcements?
Well, I think this is a position that implies that they've got the upper hand and the Saudis are in a weak position. And it's sort of allowing them to take stock of all the losses they've made and perhaps come back to the negotiating table and find a solution. Clearly, despite the gains, the military gains, I would say, on the Yemeni side, the losses on civilian and on infrastructure has been huge on the Yemeni side. And I think it's fair to say that obviously Yemen wants to see an end to this. So I think it is on the side of those who are making great military gains to actually tell the Saudis that this is your moment to take stock. Ramadan is coming up. This is a very unpopular conflict at the moment. And I think maybe, just maybe, if you take time to realize that you're gaining absolutely nothing from this, then you would take the wise decision. And I think it's sort of an appeal to wisdom over anything else.
I'd like to test your memory over here, if I may, Brian Terrell. Prior to the year 2015, when this war was launched, you had the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to be cited as the number one threat, national security threat for the U.S. I don't know if you recall that. There was an incident that happened with U.S. sailors. And then there were reports that surfaced on more than one occasion in this war after it began, that you actually had the Saudi-backed coalition, which involves a lot of mercenaries also, but you had them fighting the AQ, the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, actually fighting alongside the coalition members on the ground. And many of the weapons that they had were American weapons, which as usual distributed to the UAE or Saudi Arabia or the coalition members, but ending some of it ending up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Would you consider that one of the low points and also a sign of desperation in order to defeat the Yemeni army or the Ansarallah fighters?
Oh, yes. It's you know, it's an embarrassment. And we've seen that even you know, the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, well, it didn't exist before the invasion of Iraq. You know, these are the fruits of the war, so-called war on terrorism. Also, what's been happening since, you know, for all these years too. Even before this war that began 7 years ago, the United States has been carrying on a war in Yemen with its own mercenaries and its drone attacks. You know, that has been going on, you know, consistently and undermining the democracy and the social, you know, the civic and economic life of Yemen. So this has been Yemen has been you know, a battleground you know, for different forces that didn't you know, this is not Yemen's fight, but we're, the United States is often finding itself, very often finding itself, whether it's in Syria or Afghanistan, and Yemen, supporting and profiting off of the different sides of these different conflicts and exacerbating them.
A bit confusing, Hafsakar Mustafa, the relationship that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have in terms of their objectives. Because we hear more about, for example, the UAE being involved with Israel because it has normalized ties with Israel. Socotra Island, supposedly, they have set up a spying center there. And they're really interested in the ports. Of course, they want to have some control over that Bab el-Mandab Strait, for example. And even at some point, there were clashes between the UAE-backed fighters and the other fighters backed by Saudi Arabia, I guess, if that's a correct interpretation. What are the objectives of the UAE that diverge from Saudi Arabia, in your opinion?
I think the UAE, because especially through Dubai, has become some sort of powerhouse, economic powerhouse, and a major financial and trading and touristic hub. It's actually trying to impose itself now politically, and there's no better way, in a way, than to impose yourself on the battleground and show that you are actually a force to be reckoned with. So I think because within the GCC groups, the main contender has always been Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has always flexed its muscle on the smaller countries of the region, this is the opportunity for the UAE to show that not only is it a more economical powerhouse, but actually it can even hold itself militarily. And obviously through its newly found alliance with the very powerful Israel that enjoys incredible military support from the US, I think it feels that now it can flex its muscle even more in terms of controlling certain major trading routes and actually imposing itself on as a military base of actual importance locally.
Okay, and Brian Terrell, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm looking down a list of incidents that have been major in terms of the number of civilian casualties that have been killed, from whole entire families being wiped out. And many of these incidents that I'm looking at also cite U.S.-made weapons, obviously, that have been used. And then I'm looking at the U.S. President Joe Biden calling Putin a war criminal. I'm trying to put that into my logic here as to how he can call Putin that, yet we see what's unfolding in Yemen. What do you think?
Oh, don't stress yourself too hard on that, because you can't. I think also just the other day, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, made a speech about condemning the destructive behavior, reckless terrorist attacks by the Ansarallah, by Yemen on Saudi Arabia, and of course he's not condemning the attacks of Saudi Arabia on Yemen. No, we're seeing a tremendous hypocrisy, and is horrific and totally to be condemned. The Russian attack on Ukraine, to see it in the world context, it is, you know, the United States and its allies and NATO have created, have invaded many countries, created right now millions of refugees who are not being welcomed by the countries of Europe, not being welcomed by the United States. fomenting wars and in economic disasters in Central America and South America, sure. and the refugees from those wars are starving in the desert sure. south of the United States, and their children are in cages. There are people drowning in the Mediterranean who are trying to escape the U.S. wars in Libya and in Syria. And I have many friends in Afghanistan who are trying to get out from those wars. So the hypocrisy of it is more than breathtaking. It's as Dr. Martin Luther